Hello, creeps. I'll be your ghost. I mean host. As we delve the crypts of spooky movies and even spookier theory, welcome to Horror Vanguard.
I think our biggest fumble as academics was that we stopped doing impromptu jungle concerts, and that means that we've lost all sense of rhythm, so slating is now impossible.
Absolutely.
All right, a one and a two and a you know what to do. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to and ghouls and non-ladies and non-gentlemen. And I was going to say non-ghouls, but if you're listening to the show and you're not at least some kind of undead, it's probably the wrong program for you, to be honest. Hello, this is Horror Vanguard. I've started strong on that introduction, and I'm absolutely dropping the ball right now, so I'm going to turn it... Oh, I'm Ash Darrow, joined as always by John. How's it going, John?
Hey, everybody. We're doing good.
I give myself a C+.
I'm wearing my long black coat. I'm working my emo fringe. I can't podcast without my vintage 1956 Gibson guitar. But I'm excited. I'm feeling good about today.
And we're not alone, dear listeners, because this is a vampire movie, and so we are joined by, I would say, vampire experts, 3,000-year-old vampiric historian Kate from Fangs for the Memories. How's it going?
Hello. Hi. My hair is excellent. Just amazing. Can't be beat. It's huge. And I put my vintage leather driving gloves on for this episode, so no one is overwhelmed by my like piercing touch.
I mean, that's a big problem when you listen to Fangs for the Memories. Like, without the gloves, the podcast gets very distracting.
It's true. Yeah.
It's too powerful.
Electric currents are just traveling through everyone's headphones without the gloves. I'm sure you've killed so many ghouls.
For people who unforgivably do not listen to Fangs for the Memories or your other projects, which we have not yet mentioned, would you mind maybe introducing, you know, your work, a little bit of what you do, where people can find and support your public engagement?
Sure. So I'm Kate Terry. I'm a visual artist in Philadelphia. I mostly work in fiber and collage, and my work is a lot about like disability and embodiment and body horror, all things that we love here on Horror Vanguard, I'm sure. I also co-host two podcasts. One is Fangs for the Memories, which is a queer leftist and usually extremely silly podcast about Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And the other one is Tender Subject, which is about cannibalism and I think soon to be body horror, because I need to talk about Cronenberg more. from the like through the lens of movies and books and art, we don't talk about true crime because I'm very uninterested in that and in cannibalism. But and you can find Fangs for the Memories on Twitter at Fangs Podcast and Tender Subject at Tender_Subject.
And I have to say that even as a, for my sins, even as I would charitably call myself Buffy agnostic. It's fine. It's my big failing as a leftist.
I understand.
John is so far the only Buffy heretic that has dared come forth. I'm sure there are many more out there.
Oh, there are.
I have to say we are big fans of Fangs and Tender Subjects. Please do check out the show if you have both of those shows if you haven't already. They will be linked down below in the show notes. For this episode.
There are even episodes that feature the ghosts of Horror Vanguard.
It
so
is true.
We do co-sign both of these programs.
Oh, and I also do for Tender Subject, I do a collage for every episode. So you can always check out.
Oh yeah, those are great.
Thank you. Yeah, it's a way to get me to actually make my art. important for me to give myself assignments. So, yeah.
Sometimes we just need a deadline, right? Sometimes
yeah, absolutely.
I totally get it.
Yeah, I told people I would do it, and so now I have to do it. That's how it goes.
Past me has really dropped me in it now by saying I would do these things.
Oh, if only we had 3,000 years to get everything done.
Oh, man.
And speaking of getting everything done, I never get to do this. John, could you tell me what today's movie is all about?
Eve, you're ruthless. You're brutal.
I'm a survivor, baby.
In 1376, the English nobleman Richard FitzAlan died at Arundel Castle in Somerset. His mausoleum is in Chichester Cathedral. He's interred alongside his second wife, Eleanor of Lancaster. In 1956, the poet Philip Larkin wrote perhaps his most famous poem, An Arundel Tomb. Side by side, their faces blurred, the Earl and Countess lie in stone, their proper habits vaguely shown as jointed armor, stiffened pleat, and that faint hue of the absurd, the little dogs under their feet. Love is inevitably about the relationship of subjectivity to time, cast into relief by finitude. What remains of us is love, ends Larkin's poem. But what of the creatures that know no end? The vampire goes on into eternity, but not alone, for it is a creature that has always been achingly, yearningly romantic. Jim Jarmusch's Only Lovers Left Alive gives two examples of romanticism, one which looks back to an idealized past, and another that looks out into the world with wonder. Is there something political about love? Is there something revolutionary? John Donne, 1633. Good morrow to our waking souls, which watch not one another out of fear, for love, all love of other sights controls, and makes one little room and everywhere. Let sea discoverers to new worlds have gone. Let maps to other worlds on worlds have shown. Let us possess one world, each hath one and is one. To love is to enter a new world, a new kairotic time. To love is to live in a world made distinct, divided into a before and an after. And so even in the most personal and specific moments of eros, there is universal and utopian potential. Love proposes a quantitatively and qualitatively different mode of life, a place and mode of living in which we become not zombies, but truly ourselves for the very first time. We give away ourselves to those we love, emptying out of ourselves an infinity that is the very stuff of history. Memory is not simply the site of history, but its very medium. We must excavate love from history, from culture, looking for the traces of the better world we yearn for. Stuff is not enough. No matter how beautiful the object, how old the guitar, or how retro the recording equipment, it becomes meaningful only because of the humanity in which those objects have meaning. The fetishism of the object is not love, but nostalgia. But all those cultural objects belong to all of us, containing within themselves those glimpses of universality that love too can show us. As Ernst Bloch wrote, there is a spirit of utopia in the final predicate of every great statement, in Strasbourg Cathedral, and in the Divine Comedy, in the expectant music of Beethoven, and the latencies of the Mass in B minor, to which we might add Cervantes, Goethe, Milton, and most importantly, Christopher Marlowe. Too often we ignore the culture of the past, afraid of elitism or rejection, but approached as a living heritage we find revolutionary love, a revolutionary romanticism, an unfolding dialectical process in which even the quintessence of dust that is humanity can find a kind of immortality. Two souls, alas, are dwelling in my breast, and one is striving to forsake its brother unto the world in grossly loving zest with clinging tendrils. One adheres, the other rises forcibly in quest of rarefied ancestral spheres. If there be spirits in the air that hold their sway between the earth and sky, descend out of the golden vapors there and sweep me into iridescent life. Join us as we discuss Jim Jarmusch's Only Lovers Left Alive.
She was delicious.
I'll bet she was.
Absolutely perfect.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I always get so nervous doing this.
but they're always so good. We don't even need what I wrote. This is perfect.
We went on a journey.
Well, you know, I had to quote Goethe at the end there. Given that there is a Dr. Faust in this.
Yeah.
Hitting the classics. Yeah, we got the Block. We got Block. Check. We had to make sure that happened. So that's good to hear. Good to hear Ernst Block getting the shout out.
You write what you know.
And Ernst Bloch is a thinker that I think more people should be introduced to. And John, is there like a resource that might be coming out in the next few months here that people could turn to if they wanted to learn more about Ernst Bloch?
Yes, indeed there is. There is a primer on utopian philosophy, an introduction to the work of Ernst Bloch. By me. I did it. It is out with Zero Books on the 29th of March. So depending when in the great expanse of time you're listening to this, go and pre-order it or go and pick it up from the bookshop that you asked to get it for you. Again, link down below.
Yes. Or I was going to say, or if this is the deep expanse of time and you're hearing someone who is an anti-Litcritian about the origin of John's writing, you can tell them to fuck off. John did write all those things.
Anti-Litcritian.
Well, let us get into our cool retro car and drive into the sublime ruins of the deindustrialized formalism zone.
So how do we feel? This is a very musical film today. How do we feel about the not only the score, but the use of music as an element in the plot and a character in its own right?
Okay, I suppose the question is, like, is Tom Hiddleston convincing as what if David Bowie was a vampire? is that convincing to everybody?
I think he's fairly convincing, yeah. I mean, I think one of the things that's really interesting about the music in this movie is, like, some of it is Jim Jarmusch's band.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, like, and he is someone who has always used music and, like, musical cultural references a lot in his movies. So it's something you definitely expect from a Jarmusch movie. And then, you know, to have Tom Hiddleston also as a musician who, you know, lives in this kind of incredible, almost like a mega coffin of musical instruments and and equipment. And, you know, tends to like he kind of stopped at analog technology, which I think is really mm-hmm. interesting and something to think about with him too. I feel like all of his like aesthetic is very like analog equipment meets like Victorian velvet and like fringy lamps. but yeah, I find him very believable as a Bowie type stand-in.
Yeah, I think so. I think the opening scene is really good. Where it's like this list of beautiful vintage guitars
mm-hmm.
That he kind of explains, and of course one is named and it's named after a 16th century English composer, which is a nice detail. The music itself, I think, is really... There's some really interesting choices. It's quite... There's a sort of, like, goth rock, post rock vibe to a lot of the stuff that's supposed to be Adam's music, which is, you know, Jarmusch's band. And I'm like, did he cast Tom Hiddleston because Tom Waits was busy?
I guess he needed a younger...
Yeah.
A younger vamp man, you know.
And Jarmusch couldn't play the role of Adam and direct. That would have been way too much to juggle. So, like, it's a good self-insert actor choice.
Yeah, very much. And I like...
Although now,
like,
I mean, want Tom Waits in this.
Go on. No, I mean, I love, like, that kind of, like, psych shoegazy kind of music anyway. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. And, like, have always been attracted to a mopey goth type. So, like, I get it.
Whomst among us?
Whomst among, yeah.
Like, we've all been there. Like, you know, people will go around to a guy's house and he has a collection of, like, vintage guitars and no working bathroom. And,
and you're like, it's fine. I'll piss it's in the fine. Garden.
Oh my god.
I really like the fact that the film takes super seriously, like, the aesthetic potential of music, because the whole mm-hmm. point is, like, Adam is bored to the point of literally desperately trying to figure out how to kill himself, but, like, the thing that is, like, the great motivating... There's a kind of sublimity to the music in this, right? It's a kind of higher plane of existence. Mm-hmm. And I think what the film is so good at is showing, like, exhausted libertines. Because clearly yeah. these two, like, lived it up, like, back mm-hmm. in the day. They've got so many stories. But I suppose, you know, over the centuries, the thrill of it has kind of worn off. And what's left for Adam, at least, has been... like, recording music and getting really annoyed that people are like, whoa, this music fucking rules.
And I think something I found really interesting, and like, Kate, you brought this up, is that, like, but we'll talk more about Eve's interests in a bit, but, like, we could see by the selection of books that Eve has picked out that her interests are incredibly diverse. They've stayed current. They're wide-reaching in terms of, like, the literature she's reading, both in fiction and outside of fiction. Whereas Adam, like, as Kate, you were saying, like, he stops at, like he doesn't move into the digital space.
Yeah.
Right? He's got real-to-real. I mean, he's got so much tech that I wish that I had, sure. But, like, you know, he's even, like, he makes a lot of, like, disdainful comments about YouTube. And, like, the Luddite in me really appreciates that, but also, like, I find the dichotomy really interesting, because he's got, like, just a king's ransom in analog music and recording equipment and guitars and, like, stuff that's, like, the affect of, like, blues and rock, and that's predecessors of that genre, or those genres rather. But there's no, like, there's no synth technology. There's nothing digital. There's no, like, sampling coming out of this. There's no, like, leaning towards, like house, rave, hip hop, and even, like, setting this in Detroit too, and, like, having a weird absence of, like, a lot of the music trends that came out of Detroit was something that I also found to be really interesting. And that kind of, like, the vampire is always this kind of aristocrat, right? There's always this kind of, like, aristocratic contradiction within the vampire, and here he is, like, so rich, so successful, so hot, so perfect, and so bored because he can't properly look at the world around him, and he's stuck inside of this, like, very narrow bandwidth of, like, what's cool, and he can't quite get himself out of that.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, and I mean, I think, you know, Eve, that's something Eve talks to him about, you know, that he doesn't mm-hmm. have friends, he doesn't associate with anyone, he doesn't talk to the others, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. And he certainly doesn't talk to zombies, except, you know, to get more guitars.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's got like a zombie handler.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah.
Yeah, I almost think that's, like, There's like a weird age gap going on between like Eve and Adam, because Eve is like textually centuries older. She's so much older as a vampire. And Adam does have this kind of like mopey late teens, early 20s. Like, I have seen all that is cool and I am done with this world energy. And Eve is like, oh, no, sweetie, just give it time.
Yeah, she's like, I was 500 once. I experienced that. Yeah. Now I'm 2500. Yeah. And like, get an iPhone. It's not that big of a deal.
Yeah, I mean, he's an old-fashioned, like, romantic. And slightly, a bit of, a reactionary. And I don't mean in a mm-hmm. political sense, but in, like, an aesthetic sense. So, like, it's stuff that's old that's good. And yeah. I think Ash is so right to bring up the fact this is in Detroit and there is no like synth, there is no electronic music, there is no disco, there's barely jazz. It's mm-hmm. it's very like rockist music, as like rock yeah. is like the proper form of music.
Like the near total absence of like pop at all in this one. Like there's just like so fascinating to see. We could talk about like intertextual referencing too and bring in a little bit of Eve here, because like again, like when we see like Eve's packing a bunch of books in her suitcase and we see like everything from like pop relatable, intellectualism relatable. Yeah, it's in infinite jest is in there because like that's everybody so smart funny. Has to at least try to read it, like, and then but then there's like, you know, we've got like world literature from all over the planet, we've got science books, like the kind of breadth of her interest is so wide. And she's still so vibrant. And then we've got like her mopey boyfriend that's like, I don't know, complaining about how a good album hasn't come out in the last 40 years or something like that.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, four centuries.
Yeah. I think it is funny that, yeah, he lives in Detroit, but like his Detroit, you know, I was thinking like, mm-hmm. is there a time when he was part of the world more? And was that like mm-hmm. his Detroit was like, you know, the 50s, 60s, you know, just as like Eve is living in Tangier, which also had its like bohemian heyday mm-hmm. in the 60s. Like, what was their life like then, you know? And like Eve has kind of kept going, but he has like fully sealed himself off and now lives in a neighborhood that no one else lives in. He's, you know, completely mm-hmm. alone.
I'm just wandering around in his beautiful fashion late at night.
Yes. Which is really like goals for a, you know, a femme. Like I wish that I could just wander around late at night in my fabulous outfits, but
I spent so long hunting for anything that Tilda Swinton wore in this movie. And ultimately found an interview with the costume designer who custom made everything for Tilda Swinton to achieve like a timeless look and this kind of bohemian vibe. So tragically, no, you cannot look like Tilda Swinton in Only Lovers Left Alive unless you have advanced sewing skills.
And I love like her outfits are, like you said, they're timeless and they're like, you know, kind of like muted neutrals mm-hmm. and she wears a lot, there's a lot of like yellows and blues mm-hmm. in her house, and you know, kind of like diaphanous fabrics and stuff like that, and it's so different from, you know, like aesthetically Adam has like that vampire, you know, the vampire
oh yeah.
down, and Eve's is so different, which is super interesting. I think it's like, again, tied to her maturity of, you know, being 2,500 years old. Like, she's ageless and timeless as lived through so many centuries.
Also, this is just a really beautiful looking film.
Yeah.
Like, this film looks just gorgeous. I know Jarmusch wanted to film it on film rather than digital as well. But ended up shooting it on a digital camera, but it has that, again, that kind of like slightly retro, slightly timeless quality to its, particularly to its color palette. I think the night scenes are just, again, just gorgeous, gorgeously composed, wonderful lighting. Ash, I know you probably know a little bit more about this than me, so what are your thoughts on like this that aspect of the film.
I mean, usually when we're talking about nighttime in a horror movie, it's because some director tried to do day for night and they totally screwed it up.
Yes.
So it's really good to see someone who can actually shoot at night and kind of retain. I think like this is one of Jarmusch's great strengths, right? Is shooting at night and still retaining the kind of like darkness and depth and solitude and highlighting and the kind of like shape and chiaroscuro that you can do at night that really doesn't work during the day. Like these, like every shot is just so velvety and rich, and you can really feel the depth of everything. So we've got these like layers of rolling darkness, and I think that works. That works kind of like the whole movie has a very timeless feel, even though like there are smartphones, yeah. So like it's like gated to a particular time, but like everything feels so vaguely out of the past, and by never really showing us daylight, I think it doubles down on that in a way. Like it creates this kind of eternal night with like no cycles of day, and like lets us into the world of the vampires in a way that I think a lot of other vampire movies just take for granted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think the pacing of this movie feels mm-hmm. like vampire time. Mm. You know, like it's slow, but not, I mean, it's not like dragging slow. It's just there's a lot of care taken, I think, in like the way that they talk to each other and the way they move around spaces. You know, it's kind of dreamlike and just like languid, in a way that I think like if you lived forever, you maybe would start processing time as a completely different concept. It wouldn't be like, oh, I have 10 minutes. It'd be like, I have, you know, 10 years to get to this thing.
I really like that too, with like Eve flying on the plane. Cause like we get this whole thing where like, yeah, like they live, as Kate, I think you were saying before we started recording, like Adam and Eve, like Eve's in Tangier, Adam's in Detroit. And it's like a non-issue cause they're eternal beings, right? What's distance to someone who has infinite money and infinite time? It doesn't exist.
Right.
And so like it winds up becoming like much more practical, much more meaningful concerns, because they're not like, oh, I have to take the fastest flight because I have to be back at my vampire job. Eve is just like, God, I fucking hate flying because it sucks. And she's right. And that's perfect. Speaking of technology, how do we feel about Nikola Tesla?
That's amazing. What a great segue that was.
Slam dunk.
Nothing but net. Like, God, we're so good at this. I love the fact that Adam is a Tesla fanboy. I think that's so funny. He likes Tesla for exactly the reason that someone like him would do. So obviously Tesla's name has become irredeemably tarnished.
Oh my God, I bet you there are some listeners right now that are like, what the fuck did John just say?
Yeah,
I think Tesla's really cool.
The Venn diagram of Elon Musk defenders in the one half and Horror Vanguard listeners on the other. Those are two circles which I don't think should be meeting each other.
If there's any overlap there, I will be so surprised.
I got so confused. I was like, what did Nikola Tesla do? Did he get canceled?
Canceled Nikola
Tesla. No, Tesla.
The fact that Tesla signed his name on to an Elon Musk project, I think is beyond unforgivable.
Yeah.
Do better, the ghost of Nikola Tesla.
Yeah, exactly. Do better, you weird European who was apparently in love with a pigeon. Tesla's biography is wild. But this idea of like Tesla represents this kind of decommodified figure of technological production, right? So mm-hmm. Tesla was not interested in making money. This is famously why he had many of his ideas stolen. He lived in extreme poverty and was a genius of a level that like I don't think we'll ever see again. But Adam likes it because it has a kind of elegance to it. Tesla's solutions to the problem of electricity are elegant. And he thinks that the modern world is kind of like just chaotic and ugly and doesn't mm-hmm. really like how it functions. And this is what I mean when I talk about like this reactionary romanticism.
Yes, yes.
Because it's always about going backwards, right? You always have to get back to like the proper music or the proper technology or like the right way of organizing things.
Yeah. And also, I mean, I think on the other hand, there's this interesting idea of, you know, him being an artist and wanting people to hear his work, but then also not really wanting the trappings of being famous. And, you know, I mean, luckily for him, he already has his own money, so he doesn't need to work to, you know, make his art, which, God, I wish that were true for all of us.
Wouldn't that be great?
And then you don't have to wish that the fame came along with it. You know, you don't need that part. You get to just be an artist and people get to just listen to your work. And I think that's also what he sees in, you know, why he valorizes Tesla so much.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But of course, it's like not getting to care, getting to not care about being able to make a living depends upon already having all that money.
Certainly. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And this is the aristocracy of the vampire coming back into this too, because I think there's something that like is pushing into the politically reactionary like spectrum here. And that's like, you know, we see him like, oh, the power goes out at his like crumbling Detroit Victorian mansion. And he goes outside and fixes his little like Tesla free energy engine. And then, like, you know, he's, like, looking at, like, a knot of cables and cords on the walls. And he's like, oh, fucking zombies. So gross. And it's like, bro, you have the free energy machine buried in your yard. Like, you could just give that to a bunch of human scientists in a way that would let that technology proliferate and relieve yourself and the zombies, in quotes, of this problem. And so we see here the kind of, like, that aristocracy, that having wealth, that not being, like, integrated into the oppressive systems of capitalism, because like we never get the Twilight line in this one where they're like, we make our money by manipulating the stock market because we're vampires with superpowers. Thumbs up. You know, they're just rich because they're ancient vampires, and of course they're rich. They've been alive for 3,000 years. They figured something out. And I think that like his kind of disdain for like zombies and like people in modernity and modern technology and modern problems, like, slots in so nicely to his like fetishizing of like all of this like properly coded, properly aestheticized like vintage music.
Mm. Yes.
When one should be fetishizing Twilight, which is the only correct thing to be a return with a V person for, taking us into our next point.
Elegantly. Let's do it. Let me just take the temperature of the podcast. And what's everyone's thoughts on Twilight? And I am not a Twilight expert by any stretch of the imagination, so I'm super curious to know what you both think of. This comes out just as the Twilight films finish, I think. I might have, or at least there's like very, very small overlap between the end of the Twilight franchise and this coming out. What do you both make of that, like, historical connection?
Well, let's turn to our resident vampirologist, Kate from Fangs for the Memories, the best and only podcast about vampires.
I am a bad vampirologist, as I really ignored the Twilight franchise. I think I was at I was definitely at an age where the Twilight franchise was an embarrassment to me when it came out as a, like, you know, capital G goth who, like, took vampire stuff seriously. And I've only, like, I've started watching them later, and I find them to be hilarious. I also think it's really amazing that, like, the two stars of Twilight have turned out to be two of the most interesting actors of our time and have gone on to do, like, amazing, cool, weird things. So something was going on there, I guess. But yeah, I mean, Twilight, I guess just like trad vampires makes me very, very sad. I feel like when you have the ability to not reproduce and not have a nuclear family and live in a weird queer poly vampire commune, you should do that and, like, you know, not try and just sort of mimic the, you know, like, human nuclear family but for vamps. that's my opinion.
Well, you have to save your undead virginity for unholy vampire matrimony. Yes. I think that's important. Yeah, those vampires have some problems.
Okay, like the Twilight vampires are essentially like Mormon Instagram influencers.
Yes, very much.
That's who they are, right? They all live together in mm-hmm. a big house in the country. They make their money off their investments. Like it's
they're impossibly pale.
Impossibly pale. it's fine. Don't ask.
What am I? Say it.
Ice cream cake. Have you heard that one? You're very cold and impossibly pale.
Yeah. the single best line in any vampire movie is still "Hop on, spider monkey." Mm-hmm.
But, like, it's still neoliberal fantasy, right? So, like, my kind of slight... I don't know if this is a hot take, but, like, Twilight and Only Lovers Left Alive are basically two the vampire existing in capitalist realism, but with two different outcomes, which is, like, one, it's perfect and you've won, right? You get to live in your bucolic idyll with your adorable, perfect daughter and your pet dog who is in love with the daughter for some reason. We won't go into it.
That's where things get real fun.
it's fine. Or, like, and then actually you actually see the flip side of what underpins all of that wealth, which is, like, systematic deindustrialization, cultural segregation, artistic production becoming this kind of, like, rarefied. So it's like, I think it's so interesting that these two films, that these two kind of like iconic vampires are so close together, because you get the kind of culmination of the neoliberal dream. And then Jarmusch goes, actually, do you really want to know how that feels? Do you really want it to be like this forever? And you kind of just see the exhaustion underneath everything.
Yeah. I mean, I think I've been, while watching this movie, I thought a lot about that Katie Stone essay, Hungry for Utopia. Mm-hmm. You know, and rather than looking at vampires as the capital, you know, the, like, thirsty capitalist overlords a la Marx, looking at vampires as this, like, potential for queer utopia anti-work societies, you know, where, like,
mm-hmm.
they are, you know, they're incredibly dependent on humans and each other, because they have a constant thirst for blood. Like, they need, you know, and I think this movie does a really good job of shifting the perspective of, like, what it could be like.
Yeah, I think that's a really good thought that I hadn't quite, thinking about, like, all vampires in the context of, like, queer living, I think is so interesting, because this is something that, like, this is, like, one of my, like, Twilight hot takes, is that, like, because all vampires are erotic, right? All vampires are deeply libidinal, mm-hmm. because of how society is structured, because of what we're doing. If you make a vampire anything, it's going to be kind of fuckable. And, like, we've got, like, a lot of... It better be. You have to try really hard to the point where it's not a vampire anymore to make it not sexy for someone somehow. And then, like, you know, like Twilight, we could talk a lot, you know, like, and we have on previous Twilight episodes about, like, this kind of, like, misogyny and feminine sexualities and, like, you know, like, the space that Bella occupies in that context. And that's something that I think is, like, interesting here in this Jarmusch movie, is that, like, by de-eroticizing their relationship, because we don't get the thing that you get in, like, almost every vampire relationship movie where they're, like, sucking each other's blood and, like, rolling around in juices, But in this one, like, we do get a scene where, like, Eve shows up at Adam's place, and the first thing she does is she, like, holds up her hands with the leather gloves, and she's like, may I? Like, may I have permission to take off my gloves? And I'm like, oh, they have some, like, extremely convoluted 3,000-year-old Dom sub thing going on, and it's just fantastic.
It's so good. And, like, it's so good.
And I think...
Yeah, that was because, so, like, incredibly hot.
That was. It was too hot. Too hot to handle. That scene, that scene was just like, all right. And I think the thing that's really interesting about that, too, is, like, we tend to associate submissiveness and being a sub with also, like, a bunch of other, like, ordinal language things. Like, to be submissive is to be weak-willed, to be easily manipulated, right? Not just sexually submissive or submissive in a Dom kink sense. But to see the fact that, like, Eve is the one who's emotionally well-adjusted. Eve is the one who's in charge of this relationship. Eve is the one who, like generally wields the power here, and yet she's occupying this, like, submissive kink role. I thought that was such, like, a refreshing dichotomy shift going on in here. Yeah, I don't know, just some random thoughts.
Yes,
someone take this microphone away.
No, I mean, I think that's great. Like, thinking also about, like, a romantic relationship that has lasted for 500 years. You're going to play mm-hmm. together with a lot of different, like, erotic possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mm-hmm. and
they've been married at least 3 times.
Yes,
we find out.
And so, like, so clearly... they're choosing to be together over and over and over again.
Yeah, and it's clearly not a kind of normative or, like, culturally normative model of, like, oh, you're married, you're supposed to behave in certain ways, right? It's not that.
Mm-hmm.
There are the strong implications. They have arrangements, as they rather euphemistically refer to it. And yeah, there is a heavy, like, sublimate, like, the sex would not be depictable on film, right?
We would all be confused.
just deeply confused. It would last for days.
Yeah, yeah.
It'd be like a Sting Trudy situation.
You have the oppositional pole of Twilight, where obviously there's an eroticism to it. That's completely undeniable, but it's an eroticism that leads to an incredibly heteronormative final point, right? Which is marriage and a baby, because that's what sex is for. Whereas this, everything seems a lot more kind of, again, languid and relaxed and negotiated over many, 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 many sessions. They clearly have a thing for leather, but, like...
So when I think of, like, a really evolved, really mature, kink-forward relationship, the first thing that comes to my mind is anti-Stratfordian theories of the origin of Shakespearean literature. You know, the anti-pro-Stratfordian theory kink dynamic is really strong in this movie. So take it away, everyone.
Yeah, Christopher Marlowe's in this movie. we've not really mentioned that. Christopher Marlowe buried the lead. Christopher, this is a movie about the Shakespeare authorship question.
And I think this is the first movie that's brave enough to put forward the correct answer that a vampire wrote everything.
And the zombies stole it. Yeah.
I feel like Marlowe in this film is standing in for, like, a lot of other moments where they touch upon, like, this, there's a kind of, like, theory of artistic creation that happens under the surface of this film, of, like, what it means to be an artist, what does it mean to be creative, and what is the relationship of the artist to the work that they produce. Given that you're here, I was hoping you might have some thoughts on that in the context of this movie.
Yeah. I mean, I think, like I said before with Adam, the you know, the dream of being able to create your work without being dependent on the fame or, you know, all the like sort of the things that artists don't particularly want to do usually, like, you know, troll for likes on Twitter and Instagram and stuff like that, you know, the idea that that is like a possibility that people might just enjoy your work and that you would be able to survive is like an absolute utopian dream. Like, what would it be like if we, you know, as artists didn't have to, you know, figure out like what else they needed to do to like scrap, you know, to scrape some money together to make a living. Like, what if you just got to make the work that you liked to make and put it out into the world and people enjoyed it? I just kept thinking about, yeah, like how magical and wonderful that would be if that was just life as a zombie and as a vampire, you know, that it wasn't, it wasn't just available to like, you know, people who are 500 years old. It was available to all of us. And yeah, I think there is an interesting, like there's so many references to artists in this movie. And, you know, some of them are obviously like valorized, but some of them are just like, oh my God, remember Shelley and Percy? They were such little bitches, you know, like I love all of all of that, that like they've lived through centuries of like art movements and like been part of those things, you know, that they got to sort of watch some of it and influence some of it, and like they influenced it sort of silently, know, which is like obvious. I mean, you know, there are so many artists, like I don't think anything is made by one person, you know, like everything is made by many different people and inspirations, and you know, any artist who rises to the top has a million people who are helping that artist, you know, like any artist who is in a big, huge gallery has a million artist assistants who don't ever get mentioned. Mm-hmm. And yeah, there's something really cool about talking about like the secret people who maybe helped make that work.
Yeah.
You know,
I guess the other thing I was thinking about.
Yeah.
There's this idea of like the vampire is the catalyst of creativity, but also in a way to be a vampire, to be creative is to be a vampire.
Ooh, right? Yeah. It's, or a parasite.
To have these things that you are like so drawn to and so thirsty for that you end up like, I always think that kind of like any artistic or creative practice is an outward expression of something that has first gone into and kind of been filtered through a kind of subjectivity. And so like to be creative is to be vampiric, right? And I think this goes back to what you were talking about with Katie's essay. Katie makes a point that like there's a disavowal of the vampiric that's inherent to humans.
Yes.
Like we come into the world like needing to feed, needing to be fed. We do not work. We, you know, like Dracula in his coffin, we lie replete and satisfied. And it's like there's something very human about this impulse in Adam to want to be creative, but it becomes so much harder when you can only look on the world as something that is no longer as wonderful or as strange or as it used to be. Like one of my favorite moments in the whole film is when Eve is talking about the diamond in the stars.
Oh God, yeah.
Yep.
God, she's so fucking cool. It's such a cool...
Tilda Swinton could read a fucking phone book and I would be hypnotized.
But yeah, you're right that like the distance, the sort of cold distance that Adam has does make creativity more difficult. Like what does it mean to be incredibly old and cultured and know a million pop culture references and artists and movements, etc., but not live in the world and not know what, you know, death means? Like, is it possible to make, you know, super meaningful work, like, at that point? I don't know.
Yes. So this to kind of build off what you're saying, Kay, because I think this, think you said, like, one of the most important things so far here. And, like, one of the things that got me thinking was, like, so you've got Adam, who is, like you know, as John, as you said, he's a rockist, right? He prioritizes rock as the format of musical expression, right? And there's a thing that's, like, endemic to rock and blues and jazz that, though it does appear in non-rock related genres, is much smaller there. And that's these, like pro-capitalistic issues of authenticity, this, like, endless drive to develop, like, the correct canon, like, your opposer in experimental acid jazz, if you listen to these bands, but not these bands, you know, like, oh, like, this band is punk and this band is actually just a bunch of studio suit sellouts. Right. Without any, like, actual material or textual analysis of what's going on. It's these heavily aestheticized pillared categories, these silos of artistic creation. And, like, Adam is, like, so thoroughly expressive of this very, like, kind of, like, again, like, just this rock attitude of, like, trying to come up with the correct canon, the correct taxa. And it does speak to that, like, he reminded me a lot of, like, Lovecraft's character in a way, where he's, like, you know, like, he doesn't want fame. He doesn't want to work. He doesn't want to, like, be connected to what he perceives as this, like, gauche poser underbelly of what art is, you know? And then like, well, by doing that, he is, like, completely, like, severed any connections to, like, actual thriving music scenes and what's interesting. This is, like, it's 2012, and he's supposed to be, like, the cutting edge of expressive artistic music. And, like, there's not, like, he doesn't even know hyperpop is a thing. Like, there's no mention of that. Like, and so it winds up being, like, you know, for as creative as he wants to be, as brilliant as he tries to be, it winds up just being this kind of, like, so kind of enshrined to this aristocratic capitalistic way of looking at art and the creation of art, right? He's unable to see that, like, you know, he'll hate the fucking zombies morning, noon, and night for their boring, you know, attitudes. But, like, they're the ones making his music, his instruments, rather. They're the ones, you know, actually making the tape that the tape records on. They're the ones distributing these things and going into the world and getting them stuff. They're making more of this than he is on a very raw material level.
I mean, I think, just a super quick thought, I thought it was extremely hilarious that he showed Eve where Jack White grew up. Because it's so out of time, you know, like...
you're in Detroit, United States of America, Detroit, and you're like, I'm gonna show my girlfriend the coolest piece of music history in Detroit,
which is
Jack White's childhood home, and meanwhile there's a bunch of juggalos punting Faygo down the street on the other side of town, like.
Oh, so good. So good. The
most 15-year-old boy thing he did. Yeah. Babe, do you want to see, like, something really fucking esoteric and musical? Have you heard of this underground indie band, The White Stripes? Probably not.
In 2012.
In 2012.
Way after. Yeah, they're vintage retro. Nobody knows about this little band called The White Stripes.
Amazing.
Incredible.
Meanwhile, Tilda Swinton is like, I wonder if the stars make music. And Adam is like, Jack White's really cool.
Like, she's like, did you know that diamonds from 50 light years away sound like gongs?
she's there whispering to the mushrooms. Like, I'm like, I would die for her.
This is the most, like, perfect woman with no flaws has, like, trash boyfriend I've seen in a bit in a rom-com. do the mushrooms sing? And he's just like humming the bass line of Seven Nation Army or whatever. Do you think if the stars made music, it would be a good accompaniment to whatever Jack White's currently working on?
So good.
Oh,
we like to have fun here.
We have to talk about, we have to maybe start thinking about wrapping this up by talking about Detroit as well, because there, this is a very particular depiction of Detroit. It's a very particular depiction of Tangier as well. What do you think about these two cities and how this film kind of frames these spaces?
I had a moment where I thought about vampires as gentrifiers.
Yes! I was literally about to say this. Yes.
Okay, great. Yeah, go on.
No, this is 100% it, right? Because like what is Tangier? What is Detroit? These are sites of colonialism.
Yeah.
Who is largely absent from Detroit in this movie? Entirely absent? Black Americans?
Yep.
Like, What made Detroit a music city?
Everybody left, did they, Adam?
Not everyone. No.
Yeah, four years after the subprime mortgage crisis, which disproportionately affected Black Americans. Where did they go? I wonder why they might have left. Shrug.
Yeah, it's just zombies.
There's zombies. Because there aren't Black vampires in this, I guess. There are no other vampires in Detroit at this time. It's just the world's biggest Jack White fan. But no, that's the gentrification thing. I think is so important, because what is the attitude of the gentrifier in the space of the gentrified? It's unyielding disdain for everything they've ever touched or done, while hoovering it up like a vacuum and taking it on as your own and claiming you're the one who really like invented it or made it good or made it cool or made it work again. And like, that's the space of rock and roll. That's the space of whiteness in Detroit. That's these kind of like colonist visitors in Tangier. Visitors is the wrong word there.
Yeah.
Yeah. What do you think about Eve in Tangier? Because she appreciates, you know, I mean, she does have less disdain than Adam, but she is very much, you know, an extremely white woman walking through this place. With sort of vaguely ethnic music playing in the background.
Mm-hmm.
Quote, heavy quotes.
Yeah.
Heavy quotes.
I think this kind of ties into a very... So there's a number of ways in which Orientalism, I think, operates. One which is like to exoticize the other, right? The thing that's out there. But actually, it's also the place in which you can exile yourself, right? Because it represents, it's not just exotic, it represents kind of freedom, it represents this kind of like libertine, bohemian lifestyle that like stultifying Europe or America can't possibly give you. So it becomes the symbolism of like a blank space that you can project yourself into, right? As being the place where you can be kind of like more existentially
the wild,
authentic.
Yeah. Yeah, Eve does feel very much like, you know, the British person, like, you know, Gauguin or like Oscar Wilde or, you know, someone leaving to another sort of exoticized place where they can be queer, but also have no, you know, sort of like respect or understanding for the culture that they are inhabiting.
And this is so the final two scenes of this movie are Adam and Eve, which we should probably talk about that before we wrap as well, because they're, come on. But so the final two scenes are like, you know, they a series of hijinks and murders happen, and Adam and Eve flee Detroit. They do what colonizers do. Like, they do too much crime in one area, so they flee to another colony where the laws don't apply, right? And so Adam is distraught because, like, he's lost all of his instruments and his inspiration's gone.
But all my stuff is there.
and what does he do? He rounds the corner to a bar where Yasmin Hamdan, a famous Lebanese singer, is performing a beautiful, beautiful song off of her album Na Ves, which fucking rips, by the way. Go listen to that. And like, pause this episode now. Listen to the entire album.
It was pretty intoxicating. Yeah.
It's such a good album. And then Adam is like, oh, it's that scene from Back to the Future. He's like, oh, you know that new sound you're looking for? This is it. And we know that Adam is going to go home and steal Yasmin Hamden's bit. And then they go off and they like feed off of two people from Tangier. They just drink them dry as the colonizer does in the colonial like location. They're just going to like sap their blood.
Eve does say it's very 15th century. Mm-hmm. But it's very 21st century too. It's all centuries, mm-hmm. you know. That
I mean this is maybe part of the point of what I was talking about earlier in the comparison to Twilight, which is like the ending. You don't get to pretend anymore, right? You were always already mm-hmm. doing this thing that you've just mm-hmm. decided to do explicitly now, because your wealth and security and all of those objects that you fetishized have been taken away from you, and you're forced to kind of like confront the kind of true relationship of yourself to the world. And it's mm-hmm. it's a really bleak ending.
So bleak.
Yeah.
Because like everything they've had now is going to be gone forever, right? So what's going to happen? They're probably going to run away. They're going to move again. And there's this kind of like they become these kind of, instead of being like these kind of romantic figures as they were at the beginning, they become tragic figures by the end, right? They become mm-hmm. figures of tragedy, where they'll always be like the wandering outcast who kind of rolls into town, causes violence, feeds on you, and then is gone.
Do you think they turn them, or do you think they just feed on them and doesn't that, matter?
I think that is... Oh my God, there's so much... This damn movie's too good. Jim?
Yeah.
Jim Jarmusch, make your movies 20% less interesting. They're too rich with stuff to discuss. But no, so we have Ava, Eve's sister, mm-hmm. Who is a younger vampire and a source of trouble. And like, you know, she's up to hijinks because she's so youthful. And like I found that to be really interesting with their three characters, right? Eve is the oldest. She's very mature. Adam is in his like dejected late teens, early 20s, where he's too cool for school. And Ava is still in that like rowdy, youthful, I'm immortal, nothing matters phase. And so, like, that was really interesting. And, like, you know, Ava, like, winds up killing a zombie friend of theirs, the guy who gets Adam all of his instruments. And, you know, they're like, oh, well, she could have at least turned him. And their attitude isn't, like, one of compassion. It's, like, this kind of, like, disdainful utility. Like, it is the way rich people speak about poor people. You know, like, oh, well, you killed my favorite cleaner. Come on, you know, like, it's just like, that guy got me the best guitars, not that guy was alive with thoughts and feelings.
Yeah, that part when Ava comes in feels very Interview with a Vampire, because yeah. they like mm-hmm. they occupy mm-hmm. sort of the same age groups.
Yep.
They become parents in a way.
Yes.
Right. Mm-hmm. Which is like, I want to stay up late and have ice cream. And they're like, no, can you go to bed, please? It's mm-hmm. almost light out. And you're like, do you get it? Do you get it? it was basically like the middle third of this is basically like a very dry vampire sitcom.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, and obviously, a very Interview with the Vampire, this idea of, like, youth being linked to appetite, or, like, uncontrollable appetite, and causing, like, mm-hmm. Age being this thing which is supposed to have restraint, or the elevation of taste, right? The point is not mm-hmm. that she's hungry, the point is that she feeds too much. And, like,
yeah, taste, she can't stop
taste
herself.
Taste is this, like, super interesting vampiric and aesthetic category. Because both of them have great taste, right? Mm-hmm. Like mm-hmm. all of the '50s guitars are cool. Her library collection fills me with a deep, unnameable yearning.
Mm-hmm. But although they also... disrespect for book spines.
but they have these very refined tastes, and like the whole point of the film is that taste won't save you. It doesn't make you better than anyone,
right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the all of the money that you have, all of to get the good stuff, which is like what they call the the good, pure, uncontaminated blood that is difficult for, you know, most vampires to get, I'm assuming, at this point. Mm-hmm. As soon as that runs out, they go pretty quickly back to what they've always disdained, you know, mm-hmm. As the true nature of the vampire, which is to be hungry and you know, bloodthirsty.
Yes, this winds up being a better critique of consumerism than like a lot of zombie movies. Even this is, I guess, like a pseudo zombie film for all of its use of the term. Mm-hmm. But like they do, like that is so incredibly revealing at the end. And like your question from earlier, like, does it matter if they turn them or not? Like there are a lot of important things within the "do they turn them or not" conversation. But I think a related thing that I thought of with that is like it kind of doesn't matter in a certain sense, because either way, that couple from Tangier, like they're being used by a colonizer. Yeah. Like that is their utility in this scene. It doesn't, whether or not they get turned, it's because the colonizer who drank all their blood was like, these children have mined so much cobalt, we should give them something.
Yeah, or we're bored and need a new, you know, a couple new toys or,
right,
you know.
Yeah.
You know, because Adam says, like, I get the woman.
Yeah.
Which again, like a big neon sign falls down over Adam's head that just says "not gay" and it starts flashing in like really bright letters, just in case you had any thoughts up to this point. The movie wants you to know that.
But this is like, again, this like the objectification, right? The whole point of the vampire is that humans, you no longer become a person, you become an object, right? An object that is there to fulfill needs or desires of the other. And actually becomes like the mediating object for two vampires to express their desires, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Which I is, I do love... Oh, go on.
I was just about to say, which, you know, there are worse ways to go.
Oh, being sucked of all of my vital essences by vampire Tilda Swinton. Ah, oh no.
Tilda Swinton and Tom Hiddleston saw you from across the bar.
And, and would like to really drain your life essence. I would probably really say yes, honestly. But yeah, they're not given any agency. You know, they are seen as objects and not subjects.
Yes.
If Tilda Swinton and Tom Hiddleston just asked, I'd be like, yeah, totally. Let's go.
And that's like,
where are we going next?
And that's like also something in this that I find to be really interesting, right? Is like Adam's character is so jaded, so done on with this world. He's been there. He's done that. He's an immortal vampire. And like when it comes time to engage in a pseudo-sexual interaction with someone, he like lays down very specific and strict cishet gender boundaries. And I'm like, that's so revealing for his character in that moment, because he's like there's that his character is just soaked with this unspeakable reluctance to go beyond his own self and the kind of strictures of his ego. These things that were like very obviously inherited from the zombies he's got great disdain for, and for all of his evolution as something like beyond the object of his loathing, like he's really just mirroring it as hard as he possibly can. Like how much space is there between him and like every flagging hair metal rocker, you know, that's just like so sick of all the new music that's coming out these days?
Or Jack White, perhaps.
Oh, yes. Welcome to our new show, the Jack White Theory Hour, where we discuss humanity's most influential artist, the person who put Detroit on the map, Jack White.
Mm-hmm. Any final thoughts on the movie? Any last things that either of you want to make sure that we cover?
I am satisfied. I have had my fill of bloody discourse. Kate, is there anything that you'd like us to touch on before before the sun starts to rise?
No, I have to get in my coffin soon, I think. No, but this is just a wonderful, beautiful movie, and I hope everyone goes and watches it. Yeah.
But very quickly, before we wrap this up, can we plug all of your stuff one more time?
Yes. Mm-hmm. So I have, actually, you can go, I'll add another plug. I have a website of all of my art, which is kateterry.com, kateterry.com. So you can see all of my work. And then my two podcasts, I co-host a Buffy podcast with a queer leftist bent that's also extremely silly, which is called Fangs for the Memories, and that's Fangs Podcast on Twitter. And a cannibalism podcast where we talk about books and movies and art called Tender Subject. And that's on Twitter, tender_subject.
And again, we're going to link the website. We're going to link the show, Twitter accounts. We'll link the show's SoundCloud pages as well. Please, if you haven't already, listen to Tender Subjects, listen to Fangs for the Memories as well.
Yes. Links, show notes. Thank you, everyone. The horrible sun is rising, and I need to make a pretentious blog about how there hasn't been authentic music since Nirvana. goodbye, everyone. Sweet dreams. I hope the daylight doesn't burn.
Sleep tight.
We hope you've enjoyed the Dread Discourse. Until next week, stay spooky.